Welcome to Pretentious, a podcast about the albums and artists that have shaped the past decade of indie music culture, as chosen by Pitchfork Media. I'm Trevor Ickrath.
I'm Dylan Flynn. Trevor Ickrath, New Year is upon us in our timeline, which means the same is true for this show.
Yeah, welcome to Season 2 of Pretentious 2011.
Nice. We got one of those, like, Seinfeld Season 1s, the abbreviated first season. Now we're gearing up for a full episode order.
That's exactly how I was thinking about it. I'm so glad you said that.
And, I mean, I think you look back on our first season, sterling. Unimpeachable. Give those boys, first of all, give them their own studio backlot. I expect to be seeing like a fake movie theater set that we're always hanging out in front of in season two. Yeah.
What celebrity would you want a studio to add to our second season after we start to be successful, a la Danny DeVito in It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia?
What a great question. Here's my initial thought. You know, she just turned 99 years old. She had her hot run where the internet loved her. Let's get Betty White in here, living mean Betty White, to talk about these records.
I'm trying to think of the worst canceled celebrity to be stuck with on our podcast. Like, they're trying to maybe, like, rehabilitate him in, like, a gradual way, so they're going to stick him onto a hot new podcast.
Yeah.
Maybe, like, TJ Miller or somebody.
Oh, TJ Miller just, like, spazzing out, doing his hyperbolics. Yeah, that would be a whole thing.
It'd be awful.
What do you remember about 2011? Because I have like a very specific idea and feeling going into this season about like the kind of year that I thought 2011 was musically.
I have a historically terrible memory, which makes me a great candidate to host a podcast like this.
Right.
So I don't remember too much about my own personal 2011. It just was kind of like a year where nothing really happened to me. I kept going through college. I was like 21, 22 years old. It was pretty boring times for one Trevor Ickrath.
I remember it being a year where we got both a Tom Waits and a Kate Bush album. I remember that.
I remember about halfway through the year, I was feeling really anxious about not having enough albums that I felt passionate about to make a top 10 that year.
Thank you.
I was like, I need two or three more guys to like come through or else I'm not going to be able to post this thing on Tumblr.
You took the words right out of my mouth. It's like I was sitting around waiting for somebody to fucking do something.
Yeah, after 2010, which is just a marathon of like contemporary classics, 2011 really did seem to pale in comparison at the time, I think.
There were definitely some like promising guys doing some things that were like not up to the standard of their later things. I'm thinking of guys like The Weeknd and Frank Ocean and stuff like that, but just nothing I was really sinking my teeth in. But I'm wondering if over the course of this season, we're going to come away with a different feeling about this year.
I'll be interested in like revisiting these albums in the same order that I originally listened to them in, because throughout 2011, I was a very active Pitchfork reader, and I definitely picked up every best new music that they reviewed.
Yeah, this season, like no spoilers, obviously, but there is at least one record on this season of Pretentious where if you like hooked me up to a polygraph examination that would decapitate me should I tell a single fib, there's a record this season that I'm not sure if I've ever heard front to back before. So that feels weird.
There might be a couple for me too, but
hopefully we'll get a taste for what 2011 is here in the rear view. That's the point of this show, to look back and to consider the present as we contextualize the past.
Maybe listening to some of these albums again for the first time in so long will result in us digging up long repressed memories. And it actually turns out that 2011 was like the most traumatic years of our respective lives.
I mean, one thing to say is with this record we're talking about today, I certainly had like a new experience with it. So that's something.
Cool. I'm looking forward to talking about that record with you. But before we do, why don't we do what we do every episode? Hop on our time machine, go back to the week when this thing came out and see what was going on.
Excellent. January 25th, 2011, in the news, the Arab Spring movement kicks off in Tunisia when demonstrators take to the streets to protest chronic unemployment and police brutality.
Are you sure they weren't protesting something like indie rock's recent reevaluation and acceptance of sophistopop.
Yeah.
I think everyone in the Arab Spring was really just mad about too many saxophone solos.
They were like, we need a new head of state. We can't start pretending that Kenny G is cool. What about the number one movie that year, or that month rather, The Right, a supernatural horror movie starring Anthony Hopkins?
Some of the long whispery monologues on this album are, dare I say, Hannibal Lecter-esque.
But is it just me? This is the first movie we've mentioned on the show that I have no idea what this is.
No, when I think of Anthony Hopkins, I think of Silence of the Lambs. I've never heard of The Right.
Fair enough, though, because it is January. Classically, the dumping ground of all the shit that's not going to do anything for studios.
Like last year's appropriately titled Doolittle.
Hey, happy birthday to no one singer Alicia Keys, who turned 30, which means she's turning 40 now. Happy birthday to Alicia Keys today.
No one is also the exact amount of people I know that dislike the music of Alicia Keys. Alicia, happy birthday.
American pop music royalty. Good on you, Alicia Keys. But let's talk about British indie rock royalty. Maybe he counts. Do you want to talk to me about a little guy with a big hair by the name of Dan Behar?
Yeah, let's talk about Dan Behar and his band Destroyer, whose album we're going to be talking about today. It's Kaput, released on January 25th, 2011.
Let's get right in the front of this episode and say, great album title.
Yeah, Dan Behar is a very literary guy, so he has a lot of great album titles, a lot of great lyrics, just very dense material that you can really get lost in.
A well-read songwriter is always such a specific flavor. Let's look back on the origins of Dan Behar, though. Tell me about his very early days.
Sure. He was born in October 1972 in Vancouver, British Columbia. And growing up, he played in a number of Vancouver-based bands, but he primarily performed under the name Destroyer.
And he released that first Destroyer record in March of 1996. It was called We'll Build Them a Golden Bridge. I don't think Pitchfork, it was kind of off the radar. I don't think Pitchfork...
They didn't review it at the time of its release, but they did review it when it was reissued by Scratch Records in 2006. They gave it a 6.5 and said it sounds about as good as primitive lo-fi folk can.
Faint praise.
Yeah, there was a lot of primitive lo-fi folk going around back then.
So Behar's like first, you know, proper meeting with Pitchfork would come in the year 2000 when the site reviewed the fourth Destroyer album, Thief, which got a 7.9 from Pitchfork, very respectable, and a positive review from contributing writer Matt LeMay, who spends most of this review, Trevor, kind of writing about how Behar sounds like if you mixed David Bowie with Robin Hitchcock. Kind of a one-note, one-idea review.
Fortunately, it's not all we're going to be hearing from Matt LeMay today. He's one of those great reviewers you and I occasionally come across who like has the pleasure of reviewing their favorite band for Pitchfork as their albums come out. Like, didn't we have a guy who did that for Deer Hunter?
There's something so satisfying about it where you get to like, I don't know, it's like you're watching a little movie happen or something.
Yeah, there's a continuity between the reviews. You want to see what they think of this next one and then this next one.
Yeah.
But I had actually never listened to Thief before preparing for this episode. I did give it a first listen in preparation for the show. I thought it was pretty good, like as far as Destroyer records go. It was like solid.
I didn't revisit it this time. I know that I listened to this record back in 2008, 2009 or something like that. I remember the early Destroyer stuff being like not feeling like I had the patience to really get into it.
There's a lot of it, and a lot of it does kind of feel a little samey. But I really like this track that we're going to play, Destroyer's The Temple. Do you want to listen to it?
Hit me!
And though the solitudes have won, I cannot begin to crave you. Please spring us, Madeline, from these rusted jails of lust. We live in, I'm living in. I will find you, Lord, in the classified loves of three good women. You are familiar with these terms I've
a bad first introduction to Destroyer, that song, I would say. It kind of gives you a taste of Dan Behar's original work as like a very wordy singer-songwriter.
I thought that sounded fucking great.
Yeah, it holds up really well. It's aged terrifically.
That I would have clocked a song like that being mid-2000s, very ahead of the curve for that slightly yelpy barroom indie rock.
Sure, and I think throughout his career, we will kind of continue to see Dan Behar be a little ahead of the curve.
Agreed.
What happened next in his career, though, was like pretty important. He, in 1997, he started playing and writing in a music collective that would become known as the New Pornographers. And this is,
I mean, if you don't know, this is a star-studded affair, the New Pornographers.
Yeah, this is a super group, right? Comprised of a number of various well-known Canadian musicians.
You ever heard of Nico Case?
How about A.C. Newman?
Sure. How about Nardwar's friend, John Collins, also of the Evaporators?
Yeah, there's a lot of people in this band, including Dan Behar.
Dan Behar, yeah. The New Pornographers is definitely like an important power pop, big, unwieldy, giant group.
And Dan Behar's first vehicle to real success. In 2001, they released their debut LP, Mass Romantic, which was also reviewed by Pitchfork, and that received an 8.4, as well as a positive review from contributor Rich Jizwiak, who wrote that he was deeply immersed in an intensely passionate love affair with Mass Romantic, to the point where my pleasure no longer feels guilty. It's ecstatic.
Nice. Mass Romantic would later show up on the site's best albums of 2005 list. It came in at number 9, so a top 10 for 2005. And on the best albums of the 2000s list, it also cracked the top 100, coming in at number 91.
Where do you stand on New Pornographers? They're a band that I've always kind of meant to get more into than I am, but have never really spent enough time with.
Give me the singles. That's what I'll take the singles. That's where I am with New Pornographers.
They've got a couple of really well-beloved albums, though. I do definitely want to get into them at some point in the future. For now, do you want to listen to this Dan Behar penned track, Jackie, from Mass Romantic?
That's a great song. Hit me with it.
Jackie, you yourself said it best when you said there's been a break in the continuum. The United States used to be lots of fun back when the man and the myth of the sands and the cliffs composed a symphony to good works and better business.
Yeah, I mean, that one rocks.
Always been one of my favorites on that record. I think it gets maybe a little overlooked because it happens right before Letter from an Occupant, the big Nico Case one, but great work from Dan, in my opinion.
Yeah, and Dan would continue to release music both with the New Pornographers and as Destroyer over the course of the next decade.
Yeah, the reception for the Destroyer's albums were kind of like all over the place. For example, Pitchfork gave their 2002 album, This Night, a 4.4, calling the songs overlong and messy. Nowadays, a sub-5 is a huge statement review on that website. Whereas Your Blues, released in 2004, received an 8.6. And another positive review from Matt LeMay, who compared the album quite favorably to a soundtrack for a Sega Genesis game about kittens studying post-structuralism.
Now that's got to be one of the most evocative sentences we've read on the show so far. I definitely want to listen to something from this album.
Let me see if I see those kittens in my head. Go for it.
Here's It's Gonna Take an Airplane.
Sticking around, 'cause when you stick around, when you stick around, people like to put things in the ground. Now in my evil empire, I am gonna be a star in the night sky above. So you think this is love? Yes, I guess so. At least something to make it from.
I don't know if that makes me think of like Kitten's studying post-structuralism, so I don't know how accurate that is, but I do really love that sentence. It's like naively beautiful and can only be written by somebody who is like clearly really enthralled by what they're writing about.
Definitely. And like, you know, probably in the journalistic atmosphere of Pitchfork at that time, you know?
I just like thinking about Matt LeMay as this excitable guy in the Pitchfork office who was like, you guys gotta listen to this album. It sounds like a Sega game about kittens.
You know what? I gotta say, I kind of heard it. I could see them with their little berets on going like, Julia Christopher's seminal work really underlined now. You know, I could see it.
I think the main talking point about Your Blues was that Bear kind of shifted to using MIDI instrumentation for almost all of the album's backing music, which is like a very bold move, and not the last bold move that this guy will make when it comes to deciding on a sound for a record.
Mm-hmm, definitely. I think that obviously the infiltration of electronic sounds into rock music at this time was the thing, but going so far as to use this kind of chintzy, heavily sequenced...
Yeah, MIDI instrumentation, which is usually not everybody's favorite sound.
This is also when he kind of coins his own genre. Artists will do this from time to time and be like, you know what my music is? In Behar's world, his music falls under the banner of European blues, which speaks to its unique theatrical sound. How do you feel of that as a bespoke genre?
It's definitely not the worst one that I can think of that popped up around this era. What did Sugar Rose call their music? Like Hopelandic or something?
Hopelandic. Yeah.
Or that was the made-up language that they would sing in, not the genre.
Yawn.
Yeah.
The New Pornographers, though, they did a little bit better, Trevor.
Yeah, they fared pretty more consistently than the Destroyer stuff did. Like in 2003, their second album, Electric Version received an 8.1 from the site. Then in 2005, their third album, Twin Cinema, received a 9.0 and the band's first Best New Music Award.
Twin Cinema definitely feels like kind of the defining New Pornographers' work.
Yeah, I would say so in this day and age. Let's listen to a song from Twin Cinema, another Dan Behar pen track, Streets of Fire.
Good choice. Let's do it.
Come on, come out of the rain. You're not impressed, you're just too learned. I took the book, I lit the page. Your sabbatical was burning. Sweet, 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 sweet fires in the street. Let's sully every stage. Lick my lips, twist my hips, but Contessa, I already did.
Kind of finds Dan back in singer-songwriter mode.
There's something about hearing those two singing together, like, man, the New Pornographers, just all of those people became such prominent workmen singer-songwriters, you know?
And like you were saying, Twin Cinema has kind of gone down as like the definitive New Pornographers album. At the end of the year, Pitchfork named it number 12 on their Best Albums of 2005 list, and at the end of the 2000s, they ranked it as the 150th best album of the decade.
Hung in there.
Yeah.
Here's where I join up with the Destroyer story in a big bad way, Trevor.
Next up, they released what is still one of their biggest albums, I would say.
So Pitchfork had been, you know, maybe giving with one hand and taking with the other when it comes to Destroyer, but the coveted Best New Music Award had been eluding them so far until 2006, when Dan put out the project's eighth LP, Destroyer's Rubies. The name of the band is part of the name of the album. Don't just call it Rubies, Trevor.
There's a cool kind of soft power to that, though, isn't there? Like, I really like that, especially that, like, the first song on the album is just called Rubies, so it has, like, an almost title track. I always love shit like that.
Definitely. I remember there was a grindcore band around this time, too, called Free Diamonds, and their debut LP was called What Part of Free Diamonds Don't You Fucking Understand?
It's great.
Yeah, there is a power to just like shoving the name in there, right?
And this is a good fucking album, dude. I still listen to this album all the time.
This was a huge record for me at the time. Like, this was a big one. Just the flavor I was looking for at the time.
Yeah, Behar at the time described the album as warm and lush and pretty focused on just making the band sound good and having everything sit well together. And compared to the material that would come later on down the road, it is very earthy and very, like, in the room. It sounds great.
Yeah, warm is a great word for it. I'd love to hear something from this record.
Let's listen to Painter in Your Pocket.
Great.
And I'm reminded of the times that I was a welcome change from the sight of you hanging like a willow off the arm of yet another visionary prophetess East Van Punk. Couldn't stand at all. You looked okay with the others. You look great on your own. It was 2002 and you couldn't be bothered to say hello or goodbye or stand the test of time. You did. I just tried to separate an ocean from these tears we cry. Destruction in the way you talk. Where did you get that ride? Where did you get that rocket? Where did you get that painter in your pocket?
Yeah, real good song, man. I love this album.
I think this is a terrific record. I think that, like, by this time in the indie rock world, there were plenty of yelpers, but there weren't these studious songwriters who are bringing this particular brand of theatricality. I would say that, like, there's a tradition for this kind of music, obviously. Paul Simon, people like that come to mind, but Destroyer was just, in my opinion, was just offering up a different flavor that was, like, to my ears, something I desperately needed in the music landscape at that time.
I really like this Pitchfork review, too. It's another one by Matt LeMay. He calls the album structurally complex, thematically dense, and labyrinthine in its self-referentiality. And he also does this thing that I love where he addresses, like, these supposed internet rumors that Pitchfork was going to give the album a perfect 10.
That's so fun.
It's
like
so
weird
good.
World building on the margin.
I know. And it's like, it's pushing their own legend and inflating it.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are all these rumors around us that we were going to get to 10. Sorry to disappoint you guys, but it's not happening.
Just a very 2006 Pitchfork move. You know, their stock was skyrocketing.
You don't see them break the fourth wall like that so much these days.
No, definitely not. At the end of that year, though, Pitchfork named Destroyer's Rubies the 18th best album of 2006. It also fared on the top 200 albums of the 2000s, Trevor.
Yeah, it placed at 158, which places it a little bit below that New Pornographers album, but still, decent placement for Dan Behar so far on that list.
I think it's a great record. I think it's still an argument for the best Destroyer record.
Getting closer to the record that we're going to be talking about today, though, throughout the rest of the decade, Pitchfork kind of cooled off on both the New Pornographers and Destroyer. The fourth New Pornographers album only got a 6.0. Destroyer's follow-up to Ruby's 2008 Trouble and Dreams got a slightly more respectable 7.7.
So what do you make of Destroyer being an artist that is, like, in Pitchfork's good graces but not a golden boy? Bubbling underneath the fully passed through everything they do is, like, Pitchfork's going to geek out about. What do you account for that?
At this point, I think it makes a little bit of sense. I mean, Dan had released some great stuff, but it doesn't feel like he's really released, like, a classic yet. So I think the fact that they, like, will give him these good reviews when they feel like he earns it, but he's not, like, an event band for the site, I think that fits at this point in his career.
And at this point in his career, like, the quality of a Destroyer record kind of lives and dies on the cleverness of Dan Behar. So it's sort of like, you know, you're just going to judge it against the last batch of Behar songs and think, like, as good? No, not quite as good.
I mean, 8.6, though, and 8.8, these are definitely strong scores.
But by 2009, we would see the release of Destroyer's first material that would eventually appear on the record we're talking about today, Kaput, the 13-minute-long ambient disco epic, Bay of Pigs, released in EP form backed by an 8-minute-long B-side, Ravers. Bay of Pigs got an 8.0 from Pitchfork, and they called the song, if not the single best Destroyer song, certainly the ultimate.
High praise for this one. Do you want to listen to some of Bay of Pigs?
Yeah, absolutely.
I see I've seen it all. Magnolia's a girl, her heart's made of wood. As apocalypses go, that's pretty good. Sha-la-la, wouldn't you say? Please remove your spurs. Come to think of it, remove your antlers. Haven't seen you for ages. I still fly into rages at the mention of your name, Christine. Why?
No memory of being exposed to Bay of Pigs in this release.
That's what I was going to ask you, because you were a fan of Destroyer by this point. I haven't said it yet, but I was still yet to come on board. But you don't remember this coming out?
I think this missed me entirely.
Okay.
I don't remember this at all. And worth noting, 2009.
Yeah.
So we're still
2 years ahead of the record.
Destroyer records have long incubation periods, and I mean, to speak to that, obviously the version of Bay of Pigs that we would get on the record, very different from the version on the EP. They cut at least 2 minutes off of it. The arrangement's very different. A lot of work going into this material, obviously.
And it would still be a whole nother year until Dan would announce the album that Bay of Pigs would end up on, Kaput. He announced it in October 2010. And alongside the announcement of the release, he put out a list of 22 things that listeners might want to know about the album.
I have more of a memory of this than I do of the Bay of Pigs EP. I remember this in a news item on Pitchfork and thinking it was very funny at the time.
I still don't remember this. I don't think I heard about the album until they posted the review of it. But yeah, do you want to go through this list? There's some pretty interesting entries in it.
What if we do this whole list and we just like trade off? You want to do it that way? That might be funny.
Sure. You want to go first?
Yeah. Number one, the novel Kaput by Malapart, which Behar has never read.
I like that he refers to himself in third person on the list.
Me too.
Number two, the American painter Kara Walker, specifically the lyrics she contributed to the song Suicide Demo for Kara Walker.
Number three, Chinatown, the neighborhood bordering on Behar's.
Number four, Baby Blue Eyes.
Number five, 80s Miles Davis.
Number six, 90s Gil Evans.
Number seven, Last Tango in Paris.
Number eight, Nick Bragg, who played lead guitar on every song, again.
Number nine, Fretless Bass.
Number 10, The Hopelessness of the Future of Music.
Gear Shift. Number 11, The Pointlessness of Writing Songs for Today.
Number 12, V-Drums.
Number 13, The Superiority of Poetry and Plays, and What's to Become of Film.
Number 14, The Cocaine Addict.
Number 15, American Communism.
Number 16, Downtown, the neighborhood bordering on Behar's.
Wow, we're really getting the map of the adjacent neighborhood to Dan Behar's.
He's establishing the setting of the album.
Number 17, The Lindrum.
Number 18, the Roxy Music album Avalon.
Number 19, and more specifically, the Brian Ferry song Boys and Girls.
Number 20, The Devastated Mind of JCDC, who recorded, produced, and mixed this record from fall of 2008 to spring of 2010.
3 years.
Yeah, you weren't kidding about those long gestation periods.
No kidding. Number 21, the backup vocals of certain Roy Ayers and Long John Baldry tours.
And number 22, Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, which is a 1983 World War II film starring David Bowie.
I mean, this is like a kind of a verging on obnoxious, goofy artist move, but I do think ultimately it is pretty charismatic and winning, and also oddly kind of a roadmap to this record in a legit way.
Yeah, I kind of wish I had a list like this for every album that I listen to.
Definitely, yeah, that'd be a fun thing to force artists to do. The next official release off of Kaput would come in the form of a music video for the album's title track. That came out on January 5th, 2011, And it featured, among other things, Trevor, scantily clad women, a man dying of thirst as he crawls through a desert, and a whale floating through the air via balloon.
Yeah, I watched this music video preparing for this episode. I wasn't really impressed by it.
I don't need it, but I would love to listen to this song because some might say it is the definitive Destroyer song.
Here's the title track from Kaput. Within the first like 30 to 45 seconds of that song, you clearly realize that Dan is making some choices here.
Yeah, I think that at the time, this seemed like a pretty big move, a pretty against the grain move to bring these kind of elements in to your fashionable indie rock band.
Yeah, when he said that the things you needed to understand the record were Roxy Music and Brian Ferry, he wasn't understating it.
80s Miles Davis, so not you know.
Yeah.
This element of Kaput, I can tell you, as somebody who read every archived review, is just all these fucking critics could talk about. It really opened my eyes to, like, the fact that, like, nowadays, 80s soft rock influences fucking everywhere. Everywhere.
Oh, yeah. Dan was quite ahead of the curve when it comes to that. And I gotta say, if I were a music critic back in 2011... You know, even though I kind of did think I was one, if I was really a music critic, I would have been right there with him talking about this because it was easily the thing that I thought about the most while listening to this album. This was my first introduction to Destroyer, so I didn't really know that this was Dan switching up the sound. This was just what I thought Destroyer sounded like, and it was definitely something that I bounced off of when I first went to go check this album out. I think it was months of listening to this album before it really started to sink its teeth into me and I turned myself over to it.
I don't think I gave this record a fair enough shake when it came out because I remember listening to it and thinking like it was very good sounding, but being like disappointed that it didn't kind of have that theatrical charm that I was coming to a Destroyer record for, which now going back to it, it definitely does. It's just modulated differently.
Yeah, it trades in the Baroque stuff for sophistopop and yacht rock.
Exactly. I did eventually come around to this one as well. I think probably within the year two, and definitely like put a pin in it as one of my favorite Destroyer releases, for sure.
Yeah, once I made my way around to it, I just realized what a listenable record it was, and I found myself like just keeping it on nonstop.
I was trying to think recently, well, you know, in advance of this episode, trying to think like what is my relationship ultimately with Destroyer, like in a word, how do I feel about that band? Because they're not like I don't rush to the streaming services when a new one comes out. I'll usually get to it eventually. I think the best way to describe my relationship with Destroyer is like, I'd go see Destroyer if they were in town, for sure.
I would see Destroyer live too if they were coming by me, but I do have to admit I haven't listened to a Destroyer album in full since Kaput. They're just always really big, dense releases, and I find that I just don't frequently have the time I need to invest myself in them.
They work best sitting down with the lyric sheet, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, I intend to do it one day because I still love Kaput. I love going back to Destroyer's Rubies, but it's just an undertaking, you know? I'll get around to it at some point.
You'll get around to it at some point. Let's get around to looking at the critical response to this record, Trevor.
Yeah, you mentioned critics being of a pretty sound and single mind when it came to one thing, but let's take a look at what else they had to say.
We like to kind of take everything in aggregate on this show, so let's go over to Metacritic for a little bit of data. The average review score of Kaput was 84 out of 100 based on 38 archive critic reviews.
Tiny Mixtapes, their writer Ed Commentale, which sounds like a fake last name for a writer, Commentale. He gave it a 5.5, and he said, Destroyer's new album, Kaput, may be one of the most indefensible albums of all time, but it's also a masterpiece.
Matthew Cole of Slant Magazine gave it a 4 out of 5 and said, not only is Behar personally committed to La Vie Boheme, but he tends to write songs about the type of people who have visceral aesthetic experiences relating to Italian novels and listening to opera. In his Shadow of North America, no one has spent a moment in the suburbs, and Bohemia sprawls outward to no end.
A nice kind of flip side of the coin to the suburbs, if you will.
Whenever, like, a reviewer really starts getting going with the visual world-building stuff, I always just picture him, like, you know, in his notepad, just scribbling away. Yeah. Music criticism is an art form.
Hunched over a typewriter or something. Let's talk about the common talking points in these reviews we read, because like you said, a lot of these guys were kind of saying the same thing. They mainly spent their reviews talking about how the album embraces uncool influences like smooth jazz, sophistopop, and soft rock, but they all came at it with the similar angle of, it sounds like a bad thing, but it's not actually.
Just the absolute incredulity. Saxophones, and I liked it.
You're never gonna believe it, guys. He pulls it off.
Another thing they couldn't stop saying is that Dan Behar is turning in a more restrained performance, toning down his trademark yelpiness.
Yeah, it is definitely much more smooth on this one. I frequently saw him like compared to like an aging playboy kind of character, and there is definitely something more aged about this performance.
You feel that in the way that Dan was talking about in that list of like, music is hopeless, writing music for the present is pointless, obviously that he was thinking about making a big gear shift into kind of like willful nostalgic examination, and he's like, well then I gotta sing this record different too. I gotta become a different Dan Behar to pull this off.
Yeah, they also praised the lyrics, saying they were more memorable and less impressionistic than on past Destroyer albums. There were lots of mentions of the Kaput line, chasing cocaine through the back rooms of the world.
Song for America also gets pegged as a standout track in a lot of these reviews. Not necessarily one that I associate as a major work on the record, but critics couldn't get enough.
Yeah, I wouldn't have pegged this one to be the song to come up in as many reviews as it did. Do you want to listen to Song for America real quick?
Yeah, let's hear a little bit of it, because it is a great song.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Let's see if we can see what all the hype was about. Favorite songs on the album, but it's definitely a really solid one.
Hearing the critics go so hog wild about it did like cause me to go back and try to listen to it that way. It does have a lot of very memorable elements to it. I think the vocal delivery is very signature. The groove is one of the best ones on the record, I would say. Definitely a sleeper for me, but I can see where they're coming from.
So the critics spent a lot of their reviews talking about the way this album sounded, drawing comparisons to kind of like the same handful of artists. This album drew a lot of comparisons to Kenny G, Roxy Music, New Order, and Steely Dan.
I actually, Trevor, once I figured out every reviewer was just going to name 1 to 5 of the same 10 artists over and over again, I started making little tally marks next to them every time they would get mentioned. So those were just the ones that at least 8 different reviews mentioned. Some of them, New Order, probably nearly 20 of the 38 reviews that I read name-checked New Order.
These critics really got to broaden their horizons when it comes to sophistopop and yacht rock.
I've never experienced the music journalism world in as much of a lockstep as I did in research for this record, so that was very weird.
Let's look outside the scope of like strictly music journalism. Talk about how this ranks. We usually look at best ever albums for this.
Yeah, they kind of like take everybody's lists and do math and create a super list based on it.
So we don't have to.
Exactly.
And on best ever albums, I know that this is ranked as the first best Destroyer album. It's number one.
It appeared in 419 published lists, year end, decade end, and all time. Ranked as the 7th best album of 2011. Just behind El Camino by the Black Keys. Dang.
I can't think of 2 albums that are more different than those 2.
I can imagine the people being sung about on Kaput enjoying El Camino by the Black Keys. That's the only connection I could make.
Can you think of anything the Black Keys might say about Dan Bayar to start beef with them, as they love to do?
Why don't you put down a book and pick up a guitar?
It just doesn't shred enough.
Doesn't shred.
It was ranked as the 64th best album of the 2010s, just behind The Arc Android by Janelle Monáe, somebody who seems a lot less likely to start a beef with Destroyer than the Black Keys.
But definitely similarly, literary culture nerd music. Just a different approach.
Totally.
Ranked as the 460th best album of all time, again, just behind The Arc Android by Janelle Monáe. This happened once before on this show, I think.
Yeah, I can't remember what that was, though. I wish I could.
It's always good to know when you've got 2 albums where one is exactly one album better than the other.
Let's go to what the people think, though, and check out Rate Your Music, see what they're saying.
Listen, if there's anybody I love, it's Joe Average. I love that guy. Average user review score of 3.68 out of 5 with 7,000 and change ratings counted. For this kind of like, you know, maybe heady, nerdy indie rock, that's a pretty respectable Rate Your Music score. Not necessarily the kind of music the user base of that website usually kind of gravitates towards.
It's ranked as the 3rd best Destroyer album behind Destroyer's Rubies and Street Hawk as Seduction. We didn't talk about Street Hawk because Pitchfork didn't review it when it came out, but in between the Bay of Pigs EP and Kaput, they did review it as like a reissue series, and they gave it like a 9.1 or something, a very high score.
Very high score. I don't know if I see it above Kaput personally, however.
Of the Destroyer albums I've heard, Street Hawk would be number 3, though, after Kaput and Rubies.
Rate Your Music users ranked it as the 23rd best album of 2011, just behind Undone by The Roots.
It was an album with another artist we've talked about on the show. I think Sufjan Stevens showed up on that one. Rate Your Music also ranked it as the 3,542nd best album of all time, just behind Caligula by Lingua Ignota. I don't think Sufjan Stevens is on that album.
I don't think so either. That's a low ranking, so I guess it's down in the gutters of the all-time list on RYM. Let's look at the tracks, though. I wanted to look at some track ratings. According to Rate Your Music, the 3 best tracks on this record: number 1, Chinatown, with 4.3. Number 2, Kaput, the title track, also with a 4.3. And number 3, Suicide Demo for Kara Walker, with a 4.2. Your thoughts, Trevor?
Chinatown, Kaput, definitely. Doesn't surprise me either that they both have the same exact score. I always think about those songs together. They like almost sound like the same exact track to me, with slight variations. A little surprised to see Suicide Demo for Kara Walker that high, even though it is like a real highlight of the album for me. I would have expected Bay of Pigs to be in this slot.
You know, I would expect the same thing, but I'm glad to see Suicide Demo here. It's definitely in my personal top 3 from the record.
It's a great track. I'm not surprised to see that the bottom rated track, though, is Pour in Love. This one always borders on being a skip for me.
You know, I'm not surprised to see it in this spot either, but I did find on this reapproach that there are things to like about Pour in Love.
I've always skipped that one, and I've never been a fan of Downtown, and I didn't find them growing on me in any serious capacity when I prepped marked for this episode either.
Downtown's a weak one for me too, but Pour in Love, I think it's got a pretty good melody. There's stuff about it that I like.
Revisiting the track that grew on me the most, actually, is one that I've always have loved, but it's Bay of Pigs. I think it really did graduate into maybe my favorite Destroyer song.
I loved hearing both versions of it and hearing the ways that it grew and changed as well, and it's like, it's a striking way to end a striking record.
I really love the drop in it that comes like several minutes in. It almost sounds like 2011's answer to the drop in Dance Yourself Clean.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I can see that. Definitely.
So the top-rated positive review for this album on Rate Your Music is by user Casey Durden, who gave it a 5 out of 5 and said, "The production is clean without, although coming dangerously close to, being cheesy. Behar's vocal delivery is different than on his previous work."
So even on Rate Your Music, you can't fucking get away from the same two talking points.
Yeah.
Over and over again. Well, it's a little cheesy, but it works. Pulls it off. Also, he sings different now.
Do you want to read the top-rated negative review? I thought this one was pretty good.
Sure. User Blue Vixen gave it a 1.5 out of 5 and said, "This is straight dentist dad pop crap that gives people an excuse to listen to smooth jazz Kenny G crap without sounding ashamed."
... And you'll never believe it, but he pulls it off.
Some people just couldn't get over the saxophone. Yeah. Some people said, "Saxophone? No thanks."
Yeah, that guy might want to leave before M83 shows up later this year.
I want to go back and talk to our good friend Mark Richardson.
I was a little disappointed to see him pop up, I have to say.
Matt stuck with this band for a decade.
I know, and he didn't even get to review the big breakthrough. I really hate to see it, and I really want to know what he thought of the record. Let's talk about the actual Pitchfork review, though.
It got that best new music. Of course it did. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. Awarded an 8.8, very high score. Mark Richardson, the reviewer.
Yes, and he spent much of his review, like everyone else, talking about the band's embrace of sophistopop, ultimately concluding that it's there for a reason. He made the very good point that the sound casts Behar's songs in a very particular light and reinforces the feeling of the singer as persona. Singing these songs, Behar comes over as the wizened ex-playboy. He's indulged every vice, come through the other side, and now looks on amused.
Continuing that quote, he says, "Bands can be brands or concepts that can be summed up in a line or two, which is the power of brands. It's a good thing in proper doses, but Behar's essential complexity ultimately feels human. It seems absurd to look for genuine wisdom in music in 2011 when we're constantly gorging ourselves on the all-you-can-eat buffet of postmodern web culture. But Kaput feels wise, like a mirror that actually points back at something better, something you can jam and let wash over you, but also something you can use. It feels funny, tragic, artful, and ultimately true."
That's actually my favorite part of the review, because I like what a window it gives us into 2011. It's interesting to think about ourselves already viewing like the online landscape as like, what does he say, an all-you-can-eat buffet of postmodern web culture where we're constantly being gorged, and like just knowing how much worse it was going to get. You know,
you had like auto-tune news clips, memes. It was already happening. And I love this quote too, Trevor, because I think it speaks not only to Kaput, but to really Destroyer's attraction to me, which is that they're always just a little out of step with what's going on in a way that makes them feel very refreshing.
I like the idea of the album being something you could use too, especially in these times. I like the idea of a useful album.
Yeah, definitely. Utilitarian music, I'm all about it.
So over the course of 2011, Destroyer released two more music videos from the album for the songs Chinatown and Savage Night at the Opera. Do you want to listen to Chinatown? Because like I said earlier, I really see this as like another defining tentpole of the record.
For sure, it's a big one.
All right, here's Kaput's opening song, Chinatown.
You can't believe the way the wind's talking to the sea. I heard that someone said it before. I don't care, I can't walk away. I can't walk away. Chinatown.
Immediately a very strong showcase for the new sound that he was embracing on the album.
And immediately a very iconic song, more iconic than I would in my head associate with the year 2011. So already I'm starting to think, like, are there more Stone Cold classics going to happen this year than I remember?
I'm looking forward to finding out. At the end of 2011, though, Pitchfork placed Kaput at number 2 on their list of the top 50 albums of the year.
Damn.
Yeah, very high. We're definitely going to be talking about the number 1, so I don't want to spoil it. But in 2014, the album also ranked on the site's list of the best albums of the 2010s so far, appearing at number 16. And at the end of the decade, Pitchfork named Kaput the 22nd best album of the 2010s.
So it aged with extreme grace, it would seem.
Yeah, consistently high rankings and top 25 of the whole decade.
It aged with grace in the way that music that is intentionally out of time often does.
That's a very good point.
Love to see that this one stayed in the graces as the kind of writing staff of the blog famously was kind of overturned and shaken up. This one's still to everybody's taste.
Yeah, and something it might have going for it is that, at least when it comes to like the critics, Dan Behar has never really topped it.
Definitely, and I think we should probably take a look at that, find out what happened next for Destroyer.
Yeah, there's a handful of releases we could talk about. The first one came out in 2013. That was the Five Spanish Songs EP, which featured covers of songs by Spanish new wave group Senor Chinaro.
Dan spoke to his decision to perform songs in a different language and by a different songwriter. He said, the English language seemed spent, despicable, not easily singable. Good for business transactions, but that's about it. I guess I wanted to step outside of myself for a little while. I wanted to see if I could sing other people's songs. It was all made very quickly, just enjoying the act of making music, not laboring over decisions, and walking out with a little record after a couple of weeks. The antithesis of Kaput.
It definitely didn't receive the critical acclaim of Kaput either. Critical response was like modestly positive, but most outlets agreed that it was like a little insubstantial compared to Destroyer's past work.
Yeah, I mean, I get this as like a palate cleanser for an artist who just spent 3 years working on this like very literary, very perfectionist work. But as like a consumer, eh.
His next album was also kind of a response to Kaput in a different way. His next full length, which came out in 2015, that was Poison Season. It was recorded with the full band playing live in the room together and prominently featured a full string section.
Yeah, Dan talked about this one too. He said it came from really just getting into what we were sounding like playing live and that we couldn't have done something this ambitious if it hadn't have been for Kaput.
Right. He also said that he was very satisfied with his own performance on the album, saying that it was the first record that he'd ever done that came close to his idea of himself as a singer.
In that same interview, Trevor, tell me what you make of this. He also had a very head-turning quote. He said, Kaput was the best thing that ever happened to me.
I mean, that was in very many ways like his critical breakthrough, it felt like. Up until then, I kind of got the lingering impression that people were still thinking of him like mainly in the context of the New Pornographers. And this is like the first album where it feels like he really steps out of their shadow.
Yeah, and that quote in particular, it's so interesting to think about in terms of Kaput being his high watermark, because it almost sounds like he himself is like, that's it. How am I ever going to top that? Kaput was it.
The album did not top Kaput when it came to Pitchfork scores, though. Contributing editor Jason Green gave Poison Season only a 7.6, but he did note, for an album that took an unusual amount of time for Behar to make, it feels tonally hesitant.
However, contrary to that, Poison Season did end up cracking Pitchfork's year-end list in 2015, coming in at number 43. Does that speak to maybe what we were talking about? Was 2011 a little meager?
Maybe. I mean, 2015, I feel like, was a very competitive year when it came to indie rock albums, so it's interesting to see it break into that year-end list.
Must just be, like, shifting tastes, you know? Coming up next, though, a pretty interesting record that would produce, like, some of, I think, the better-known Destroyer material in this day and age. While touring in the summer of 2017, Destroyer premiered much of the material that would appear on this record, Ken, which was released in October of that same year.
Yeah, I still haven't listened to this one, but it's one that I know is supposed to be like one of the better ones of this batch.
At least listen to Tinseltown Swimming in Blood if you get a chance. That seems like it's become one of the big works from the project to me.
And this was a kind of another like break from tradition for Behar, right? He composed the album mainly on guitar, whereas he was used to composing on the computer.
Yeah, it seemed like he's always looking to shake things up. Musically, Ken was indebted to the influences of Dan's secondary school years. Our equivalent would be high school. In particular, the late 80s kind of British alternative rock scene, specifically bands like House of Love and Church.
Yeah, I know he's quoted as saying, "This album is me singing to my teenage self." Although I think this other bit of trivia is a little more interesting. Apparently, he's also revealed that many of the songs were inspired by the resignation of Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher in 1990.
Bizarre. Interesting.
That one got a 7.8 from Pitchfork, though, and contributing writer Amanda Petrusich described the album as Lynchian and called Dan one of the most evocative songwriters of his generation.
Yeah, just sitting at that can't quite break the 8.0 threshold level, but it clearly everybody's still saying, like, hey, doing good work. He's doing solid work.
Lynchian isn't a bad description of the guy's work either. I could easily have seen him popping up at the end of one of those Twin Peaks season 3 episodes.
Oh, good point. Definitely. And that takes us to the very recent past. We can't talk about this too much because most recently, Destroyer released their 12th studio album, the trip-hop influenced Have We Met in 2020. Critics really loved it, called it a return to form, but the reason we're not going to talk about it too much is Pitchfork back the fuck on board. 8.5, best new music for the first time since Kaput. I got to go back to this one. I only listened to this record one time. I feel bad.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to eventually checking it out and eventually talking to you on the show about it when we do it in 2030.
Yeah, I mean, eventually this nostalgia machine of a podcast will become like an Ouroboros consuming its own tail.
It'll circle back in on itself and we'll devour ourselves.
Bro, we can start writing the notes for season 10 right now as albums come out this year.
I can't think about stuff like that. Let's instead think about whether this album is going to get a 10 when it is reissued and whether or not we want to bet money on it.
Listen, in this Joe Biden economy, we got to be careful with our money, Trevor.
Yeah, I mean, we can't just be cutting stimulus checks left and right here.
Will it get a 10? Interesting question for this record.
Sure, it's one that I struggled with, Dylan, wrestled with.
You know what I found myself thinking about most of all when considering whether or not Kaput had the makings of a future 10?
What's that?
What is the third act of Dan Behar's career going to look like? This seems like a guy who's going to keep doing this well into his, like, old age, you know? A guy who probably keeps office hours. He sees himself as a writer and a thinker. I feel like the only thing that I'm wondering is, like, is it possible that the great Dan Behar work might be an old man Dan Behar work?
It wouldn't surprise me, especially when people responded so favorably to how well he played the character of an aging playboy on this record.
You know, he's always looking at the past in this interesting, you know, angular way that recontextualizes our recent musical memories. If I could see him making a record, you know, in 2035, where you're just like, fuck, that's right, whatever it is, dubstep, whatever it is, that people are just like, man, this guy's so old and he's still doing it and like really showing us who's boss. Like, that's the only thing I was thinking is like, is the Destroyer story over enough for me to feel comfortable canonizing it like that? I think this time I gotta hold on to my money. I'm going to bet against.
I mean, that sounds fair. Let's hope he just doesn't end up like Mark Kozalek or whatever that guy's name is, the Sun Kill Moon dude.
Yeah, that would be a quick end. But the thing about Dan Behar is, at least thus far, he's done a very good job just keeping his fucking business out of the post. Like, he's very low key in between his releases and his tours, and you never hear about like, yeah, Dan Behar was drunk and he said this shit. Like, he's always like a professional.
Even in his interviews, he's very, very introspective,
thoughtful dude.
Dylan, I respect your decision not to want to bet $10 on this album, but I'm going to disagree with you, and I'm going to put my money on the table for a couple different reasons.
All right, hit me with them.
I think a big talking point that you and I both saw come up in reviews like time and time again is how much Kaput sounds like music from the late 70s and early 80s, which I think is interesting for a record released in 2011 when you consider just how much retro fetishism would go on to define the ensuing decade.
Oh, for sure. Musically and otherwise.
Yeah, pop culture of the 2010s was obsessed with the 80s. There was like Stranger Things, Ready Player One, the Ghostbusters remake. People were really obsessed with nostalgia.
It almost seemed like the darker and more terrible the world was getting, the more everyone was just retreating into like the comfort food of their parents.
A little bit. But before all that even started kicking off in earnest, you had Dan Behar releasing an album that's like built on the sounds of the decade that everyone would be obsessed with for the next 9 years.
I'm starting to see where you're going with this.
I think this is what's going to get you on board, because I also want to bring up the fact that over the past couple of years, there's been a big cultural reappraisal of the band Steely Dan.
Yeah, good point.
Who are, of course, known for making the same kind of sophistopop that comprises much of Kaput. So, like, between the renewed respect for purveyors of this kind of sound and the fact that Behar was so ahead of the curve, like on the cutting edge of the whole 80s nostalgia embrace, I could really easily see Kaput getting a 10. And I think it's probably the Destroyer album that most deserves one.
You make a good point, Trevor. I could totally see, like, without Kaput, we wouldn't have gotten albums like Emotion by Carly Rae Jepsen. We wouldn't have, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, I completely see it. Random Access Memories owes a lot to Dan Behar. I totally see it.
I think it could happen, but we're going to have to, wait until it happens to see.
Boy, now I'm a little nervous about my choice to hang on to my tenor. I might be missing out on a quick, easy buck.
Well, you'll have a chance to make some money back next time when we discuss, what are we talking about on the next episode?
James Blake by James Blake. We'll be back very soon because that came out on February 4th.
Oh boy, that's going to be fun to cut an episode with such short notice.
But I got to say, very interested in going back to this release because I'm so curious to figure out how it's aged. Because to me, it feels like there were things about that record in 2011 that seemed so cutting edge and so exciting that like maybe we might look back on now and go like, I'm curious. I'm just curious. That's all.
Yeah, I mean, James Blake is like somebody who's transitioned into like a household name in indie music culture over the course of that decade. And it's going to be interesting to go back to that first album of his, which I think a lot of people do still hold in high regard, but I don't really see it talked about too much anymore.
It's we'll get into it on the episode. We'll get into it all on the episode, but there's a certain kind of music, cultural appropriating music that becomes talking pointy. Like it gets,
yeah.
People love it while it happens, and then a few years later, they're like, hey, wait a minute, though. So we'll see. We'll look at it, and we'll see what we feel.
We'll get into it. For now, though, do you want to tell people where they can find us on Twitter and everything?
Yeah, absolutely. They can find us on Twitter at Pre10Pod. That is with the number 10, by the way, PRE10POD, or they can email us at pre10pod, spelled the same way, at gmail.com.
And Dylan, they can find you on Twitter at Dylan Flynn.
Or they could also find you on Twitter at Trevor Ickrath, except take all those vowels out of it, TRVRKRTH, if you want to follow Trevor on Twitter.
Dylan, I'm excited that we've started this second season. I'm really looking forward to exploring 2011 with you, looking back. And I can't wait to see what the future has in store for us.
What terrible things will we learn about our own past? What buried memories will be brought to the surface? Who knows? Who knows? But for now, thanks for listening. I've been Dylan Flynn.
I've been Trevor Ickrath.
Dig a fork in us. We're done.
Free and easy, gentle, gentle.
The wind through the trees makes you mental. For me, Nancy in a state of crisis on the cloud. Free and easy, gentle, gentle. The wind through the trees makes you mental. For me, Nancy in a state of crisis on the cloud. In a state of crisis on the cloud.
Free and easy, gentle, gentle.
The wind through the trees makes you mental. For me, mental. fancy in a state of crisis on a cloud.